Good morning and good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to our first half 2018 results conference call. I'm here with John Dacey, our Group CFO, and Eddie Schmid, our Group Chief Underwriting Officer, and Philip Ryan, our Head of Investor Relations. Let me start with a few brief remarks on the results we published this morning. The group delivered a solid set of results in the first half of 2018, with a group net income of $1 billion. We saw a material improvement in earning quality with strong underwriting performance. As in Q1, our results are impacted by US GAAP accounting changes. Excluding this impact, our group net income would have matched last year's first half results. We also report growth in the first half as premiums increased by 8%, particularly driven by our life and health business and corporate solutions, which is operating in a moderately improving market environment. In terms of our P&C Re renewals, volume is up 9% and price quality improved 2% year to date. Finally, as you will have seen, we are also exploring a potential IPO of our U.K. closed book business, ReAssure, in 2019. We believe that the U.K. closed book market offers significant opportunities and remains a growth area for Swiss Re. However, the business is subject to significant asset risk charges under the SST capital regime. Given the size of future potential opportunities, it is important for ReAssure to have access to substantial new capital. We expect to remain a significant investor in ReAssure in the context of a potential IPO. With that, I will hand over to our Head of Investor Relations, Philip Ryan, who will introduce the Q&A session.
Many thanks, Christian, and good day also from my side to all of you. Before we turn to the Q&A, I just would like to remind you to please restrict yourselves to two questions each and re-register for follow-up questions. With that, operator, could we please take the first question?
The first question is from Andrew Ritchie from Autonomous. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. First question, thanks for the disclosure on slide 23 on corporate solutions. I guess I'm just curious, would you not have expected the attritional underlying loss ratio to have improved given better pricing? Maybe clarify what's going on there. Would you expect that to improve in the second half? Is it that we haven't seen any earn through yet of the re-underwriting or the better pricing? That's the first question. Second question, just to clarify on ReAssure, I'm assuming, sorry, this is sort of a question on mechanics. In order to free up your need to consolidate the capital requirement, you would be looking to end up at less than 50%. You have to actually deconsolidate it. Is that the aim? Thanks.
Thanks, Andrew. Why don't we start with Eddie on slide 23 and maybe John on the ReAssure question?
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Andrew, for the question on CorSo. Yes, it's true, the underlying combined ratio or the loss ratio on attritional is a little bit up, a few man-made losses contributing to that. The main reason, I think we already stated this, has to do with the time lag. CorSo started to improve the portfolio, pruning some of the underperforming businesses quite a while ago. With the time lag on renewals and the time lag on earnings, this always takes  1 to 2 years until this comes through on a US GAAP earnings basis. I think that's really all to say about that. Over time, as we announced, CorSo is operating in a moderately improving market. It could achieve some growth through the Prime Lead initiative. We still keep improving the quality, particularly on US liability, as we have explained in the past, some large corporate segments where we still see a need to drive prices further up. We continue to drive it up, but it will take a bit of time until everything earns through into a better combined ratio.
What the written rate change is to the first half, not the earned.
We set the target of 5%. We're working towards that target. We're not quite there yet, so we still have more work to do. That's how I would describe it.
Thanks, Eddie. John, on capital.
With respect to ReAssure, Andrew, it's John Dacey. Yes, you're right. To deconsolidate, we at least have to go down to 49% in terms of ownership. The other important dimension will be to give up direct management control of this. An independent board of directors will be put in place where the company management would be reporting to that board.
Thanks, Andrew, for your questions. Next question, please.
The next question is from Paris Agiantonis from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Hi, from my side as well. First question again on ReAssure. I think you are saying that, you know, capital is one of the big issues for you in exploring further acquisitions. Can we interpret that you are actually looking to raise substantial capital as part of the IPO and then get diluted a bit, or do you look to basically actually sell part of the business during the IPO process and therefore get proceeds on it? The second question will be on P&C casualty. Motor seems, especially in the US, seems to be a place where there's been adverse development, and it's also a place that we have seen adverse development in the past, and also you have been saying that prices have been going up. When do you think we're going to see some improvement in motor US business? Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. So maybe John on the first question.
On the first one, Paris, if I can just be sure that we're all clear. When you talk about capital needed for acquisitions, that's within the reinsured business. Acquisitions of closed life blocks requires additional capital in the UK market for the execution of ReAssure's business. That's what we're speaking about. And yes, that's true. We obviously committed from the group real capital when we did the Guardian transaction a few years ago, some smaller deals with HSBC, and most recently last year with Legal & General, where most of the equity capital was provided by MS&AD as they came in for a 15% shareholding in the ReAssure business. On a going forward basis, we undoubtedly see that there's a pipeline of potential opportunities. For the absence of doubt, ReAssure is open for business, and we'll continue pursuing those opportunities while we prepare simultaneously for the IPO to be ready in 2019. It's premature to suggest the nature of the IPO, whether it will be an entirely secondary or a dimension of primary. That would depend on what happens with those opportunities for the business in the UK market in 2019 or even the second half of 2018. But for now, again, the objective of this transaction is in the first case to provide another source of capital for the continuation of this business and the potential growth of this business that would not necessarily be on Swiss Re's balance sheet.
Eddie, on U.S. casualty?
Question on U.S. casualty, I think, was more specifically on U.S. Motor. I think, as you correctly pointed out, motor has been quite a drag for the whole industry. The whole industry underestimated motor loss ratios a couple of years ago, various factors contributing to that. But I would say both actually on the direct side as well on the reinsurance side now for 2-3 years, we have seen significant corrections, original rates picking up and also reinsurance terms, commissions, we could improve. We continue to see improvements on U.S. motor, and I think this has to continue for a bit longer. Yeah? I think particularly in focus is the U.S. commercial motor market, which has been even under more pressure, where we have also seen some, let's say, large verdicts. So we clearly see need to further improve pricing there. But I think there is traction in the market, both original and on the reinsurance side. But as commented earlier on the course of question, it takes a bit of time until these improvements really earn through on the US GAAP as well.
All right. Thanks, Paris, for your questions. Next question, please.
The next question is from Edward Morris from JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Two questions, please. First, just coming back to ReAssure again. I just wonder if you could talk through the rationale behind why you're considering an IPO and whether this is the only real outcome now. Has it been a consideration to also look at more minority or potentially majority investors, as in a sort of trade sale type scenario? And secondly, just looking at the growth in the open book, it would appear from your slide on slide 11 that the open book seems to have written double, in life capital, double the premium in the first half that it did in the entirety of last year. So clearly the growth is coming through extremely strongly there. Is that indicative of an ongoing run rate, and how close are we in terms of the business turning a profit, should we expect, what is the profit contribution from the open books?
Great, thanks, Ed. Maybe Christian on the first one and John on the second.
Sure, thanks. So it's funny, right? You go through the years and you can see investor appetite shift from BU to BU and come back at it again. You know, ReAssure has really been the unloved child for quite some while. We obviously worked hard on it, but I remember 2 years ago everybody saying sell it, and I said this would be a huge waste of shareholder funds, right? Because you would dump it to somebody who have a very very small would pay a very small price. It's actually an interesting business. I really think there's an investor base that would really love it. And I personally would love it if I didn't have the SST and the risk factors in SST and in our own risk model, which would say, it just creates a too high concentration in asset risk for the Swiss Re group overall. And if you look where we have grown, clearly ReAssure has been more interested in unit-linked product, in a mortality product, with profits. I think we struggle more than others when we look at annuities, for example. And yet, if you look into the business, the small deals have gone. There's still some small deals around, but some of the big ones will come eventually. So if you think about all of that, it's quite clear to me, and I think I've been clear to this community for the last 2 years, that Swiss Re, it's a great business, but Swiss Re is not the best holder of this business economically. I think it's crystal clear. And so the question is more, what's the path towards this end stage, which creates the highest amount of shareholder value? And we have discussed that internally, obviously, in great length, in great detail, going through all the scenarios. And our view was, or is, that the first step was to bring in a good shareholder who shows the value of the business, and that we have done with a client of ours, who is a client of ours for more than 100 years. And obviously, you could start to have now number 2, 3, 4 in, but their relative value for our shareholders shrinks, because we have already one who sets the value. And at this stage, looking at comparables in the market, the overall market situation, I think is a relatively good time window, which might close before we are there, but it's a good time window to create significant shareholder value, in my view, through an IPO. Now, we are driven by creating shareholder value. So if anybody jumps in with a huge offer or whatever, we will always consider that and see whether that's a better path. But at this stage, since we need to have preparations and there's leakage risk, we wanted to be upfront with investors, announce it today, and start working on it more or less immediately. There's no real, pressure or anything. We're not a desperate seller. If there's issues with Brexit, if there's any issue that would prevent us from creating maximum value for shareholders, we simply keep it, right? That's fine. But I think there's an interesting opportunity at this stage. That's our own assessment.
Thanks, Sean. John, on the open
book. On the open book growth, two observations. One, yes, there is a strong growth in both the IPTA-Q and the Ellipse Life businesses, which are part of Life Capital. This was probably given an extra boost in IPTA-Q EMEA by one large MedEx transaction that was booked is unlikely to recur, so we won't see that level of growth. And lastly, there is a positive impact in these numbers from an internal group retrocession that came through. It's part of our capital management policies across the group, but it flatters the actual growth rate. So I think it'd be wrong to extrapolate this in a sort of geometric fashion, but the growth is strong, and we are very optimistic about the opportunities for the open books in Life Capital.
Thanks, Ed, for your questions. Next question, please.
The next question is from Kamran Hossain from RBC. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Two questions. First of all, on P&C and, I guess, exposure in wind season, some comments on the take this morning talking about multiple hurricanes in 1 year being a decades kind of event rather than, you know, hundreds of years event. Can I assume on that basis that your retro program has changed ahead of, I guess now that we're in wind season? Any comments on that? And the second question, just looking at life and health, I guess the uptick in seasonal claims, are you sure this isn't, are you sure this is just a blip? Kind of any comments or reassurance around that? Thank you.
Thanks. Eddie, you take them both.
So on P&C Re and retro into this season, we didn't make any material change to our retro policy. As we explained, we actually like the NatCat business a lot. We understand it. We can demonstrate. We cost it accurately over time. We see loss levels emerging as we cost for them. And as long as we can well diversify the risk, we want to keep it on our balance sheet. So what we have in place for the upcoming hurricane season is similar to what we had last year. Apparently, last year it was a unique year because you didn't have one or two very large severity events, but you had three medium-sized hurricanes plus a few smaller ones, and that explains why our recovery was lower than you would have expected. Where actually we did make some changes is on the corporate solution side, where in the past we were running quite large net retentions also for NatCat, because our thinking was this is still part of the group balance sheet, but obviously in comparison to commercial peers, the losses looked a bit out of proportion. Into this year, we have strengthened the IGR, the internal cover around corporate solution, with a bit of lower attachment point, and in particular, we also have an aggregate cover in place. So Corso would be much less affected by another series of events. Yeah? But from a total perspective, what we see out of the group balance sheet, it's pretty much in line with what we had in place last year.
Then the follow-up question, Eddy, on the life and health mortality claims, the seasonal effect we saw in H1.
Yeah, it's correct. Mortality experience was adverse in the first half year, and we have seen an increased frequency of claims, which is seasonal. Flu is a contributor to that, but we also had an above average number of severe claims. I mean, that's the natural volatility in the mortality book. On a global basis, we can well absorb this, and more importantly, we don't see any material adverse development around U.S. mortality that would change our overall view how we approach this business.
Perfect. Thanks, Cameron, for your questions. Next question, please.
The next question is from William Hawkins from KBW. Please go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my questions. In the P&C business, I've been hearing from many players about a softening of momentum for renewal rate increases. You've actually shown 104% price adequacy compared with 103% in January. So is all of this just down to sort of mix effect in your book and sort of more technical things? Or is Swiss Re believing that it's more optimistic on the direction of renewals than I guess I've been hearing from the market in general? And then secondly, this large internal reinsurance contract between Life Re and Life Capital that's boosted the premiums, has that had an impact on capital and earnings allocation between the two entities? And if so, how much? Or is it just purely something that boosts the top line of Life Re but is irrelevant to earnings and capital? Thank you.
So maybe Eddie on the first one and then John on the IGR.
On the first one, the P&C re-quality, let's say what we wrote at mid-year versus year-to-date, this is largely explained by the composition of the business that renews in the middle of the year. It's a bit more property and US-focused than at 1-1, where it's a bit more European and casualty-focused. I wouldn't say we are more bullish than other players in the market. Clearly, we're also disappointed by, let's say, the rather moderate reaction to the large NatCat losses in 2017. But what pleases us that we could drive through quality improvements in our portfolio, actually in various segments, and at the same time we could grow the P&C Re business. Obviously, the improvements were a bit stronger in loss-affected accounts, but also in other portfolios we could drive some quality improvements. The momentum is not as huge, so I would not hide the fact it is competitive out there, but at least there's a change in tide, also in terms of pressure on terms and conditions. This has eased quite a bit, so my outlook is more positive, but clearly it stays competitive and we need to do more work.
Thanks, Eddie.
With respect to the IGR, again, this has been driven by our attempts to have capital efficiency at the subsidiary levels and across the group, there's been no material impact, I think, on the relative earnings of the different businesses. If you wanted a little more detail on those IGRs, in the longer presentation, note 4 for the half-year 2018 report gives you some details for the flows.
Thanks, William, for your questions. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Sami Taipalus from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my questions. So first one is on P&C Re and large losses. I note that there was no sort of man-made losses that made it above your limit in the half. But if you could just comment on whether there was sort of below a significant amount of losses below that limit that would have affected the results in the half year, that would be great. And then the second question is just tidying up a couple of things on ReAssure. And the first one is, if you were to sell down, would that have an impact on your capital planning? Because it kind of sounds like you're probably not going to have to plan for as much potential M&A in the future, and will that increase your capital flexibility centrally? And also related to that, it wasn't quite clear to me what was going to happen to the debt that's in ReAssure at the moment, so if you could just clarify that. Thank you.
Thanks, Sami. So maybe Eddie on the first one and John on the second.
Yeah, thanks for the question on P&C large losses. As you correctly stated, we have nothing to report above the 20 million threshold. There are a few smaller large losses, but overall it's fair that the man-made large loss experience is a bit below expectation. What may be a bit surprising is that on the Corso side, we report a very large claim, 51 million from this engineering loss in Colombia, 51 million, and we don't show anything on that loss on the reinsurance side. Also in reinsurance, there is a little bit, but it's below this 20 million. And unlike in other situations, we generally see, as I explained before, rather little retrocession outside. But as it happens that we offer significant capacity sometimes both on the Corso direct side as well as behind some cedents, we can have significant shares on large single risk policies or on large construction policies. And for that situation, we actually have a per risk cover in place to avoid, let's say, out of proportion accumulation on large single risks. And in this engineering loss in Colombia, actually this external cover was triggered. And that explains why we only show this 51 million in Corso. That's their retention after IGR. But we don't show anything on reinsurance because a large part of this loss actually is ceded externally.
Great. John?
And with respect on the potential ReAssure IPO, if we find ourselves in the position where we're selling down our stake from the current 85 to something at 49 or potentially even slightly below 49, and in the meantime the pipeline has not resulted in any additional transactions, you should expect that that would free up additional capital. We're pretty far away from that moment. We've got a lot of preparation to do, and as we said, we hope to be ready to execute in 2019. When we get closer to that, we can, I think, have a re-engage on what that might actually mean for capital.
And there was also a point on debt. Maybe you want to comment on the...
In 2016, issued debt. It was replacing some bank financing that had been in place at ReAssure. It's at the level above ReAssure business, so it would not, the holding company where the debt was issued would not be part of the transaction. We would, I think, look as we would approach the IPO, what would be the appropriate level of debt and equity for the entity which goes out into the market. In the meantime, we've stated explicitly in the press release today that should Swiss Re Group no longer be the majority owner of this business, we will be sure to indemnify the bondholders.
All right. Thank you, John, and thank you, Sami, for your questions. Next question, please.
The next question is from Vinit Malhotra, Mediobanca. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Sorry to come back to reassure. Just a very simple point from my side. What is the trigger for doing this now? So it's not like SSP has changed some rules, or it's not like, is there no pipeline that you had imagined before? And apologies, you did clarify that you've been thinking about for 2 years, but in the meanwhile, you also got a new investor. So obviously, I'm just curious as to what is the trigger for reassure, really. And just on the life results, are you able to quantify a little bit this flu season effect, if it is anything? You said a bit more frequency came in, but if you could just quantify something. Thank you.
Vinit, we couldn't hear your second question. Do you mind repeating it? First one we got, but the second one.
Sorry, the second one is the life re mortality pickup in seasonal claims. Are we able to quantify that? And is there some lag effect even for further quarters that we should be aware of?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Maybe, so John, on the first one.
Yeah, Vinit, I think part of the issue, frankly, has been the success of ReAssure in recent years. Capturing the Guardian transaction, which was relatively large, the HSBC, and most recently Legal & General, we see the opportunity in this business for continued accumulation of assets underneath the ReAssure business model. And the challenge for us is the relative size of those assets to the rest of the group has gotten relatively large. There's a, if you will, a finite amount of asset risk that we would be comfortable with, I think, over time. We're not at that point today, but at some point in the future, especially if we if ReAssure engages in some of the larger transactions that we see are potentially out there in the UK market, this could become a constraint for us. And we'd rather build today the operational freedom for the business to continue to grow, to continue to transact. And doing that outside of the SST framework, I think, is good not only for that business, but potentially for the remaining businesses inside Swiss Re Group who benefit from a reasonable level of asset risk in running their operations. Christian, I don't know.
Yeah, I think maybe to add to that, right, it's not something we have decided a week ago and we just do it, right? These things need the right level of strategic thinking, consensus building, and then the time. So when I took over 2 years ago, relatively clear, we created consensus around the overall direction, and we started to implement it. And this is just the next logical step in that point. So you, maybe it comes to a surprise to you, but hopefully there were enough signals that would make this less of a surprise. I think there's a complete logic in our communication over the last 2 years, if you go back, in the path we intend to take. And so this is just the next step.
All right. So, Eddie, on the mortality claims?
Yeah, on the adverse mortality experience in the first half, I think there's not much more I can say. As I mentioned previously, part is clearly seasonal, so we don't expect that to repeat. Flu is a factor. The other component I mentioned is an average number of severe claims that is random. It's nothing to do with seasonality, so could occur at any point in time. But the key point I would repeat from before, we don't see anything material systematically that would make us to believe we have to change our view on U.S. mortality risk.
Thanks, Vinit, for your questions. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Stefan Schurman, Bank von Tobel. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Just two questions. First of all, coming back to basically the open book growth. Can you maybe just quantify how much basically this growth eat into your life capital earnings? I think it was quite substantial and that cost you some upfront, obviously, acquisition costs. And the second one on prior year developments, you show 1.5 percentage points in that. How much was related to basically HIM claims last year, so the hurricane claims you reserved for last year, if there was any positive development here, I guess?
Okay, start with John on the open book.
So the open books, Ellipse Life is a little more mature business than iptiQ, which is obviously a effectively a tech-enabled startup within the group. These are both primary life companies, and precisely because they are able to capture the fast growth that you see in the premium line, it will be some time for break-even of iptiQ in particular. Ellipse Life, I think, is there, but the contribution to earnings is modest. And we continue to expand that business in new geographies. As we expand the business in new geographies, we're going to have to invest in those new geographies. So I don't think you should expect the open businesses of Life Capital to have any material impact to earnings in the near to midterm, as long as we see that investing continues to grow value for us. We will think potentially as the IPO of ReAssure approaches for being able to provide more information on value of new business or some other metric which would give you a better sense of how we see the value creation in the open book businesses.
Thank you. Maybe Eddie on the PYD?
Yeah, Stefan, on your question regarding 1.5% favorable prior development in P&C Re. Actually, from him, we only had very moderate releases. We think we're adequately reserved for the big hurricanes. Actually, there was some adverse development this time for property overall, but that is mainly driven by some losses out of Japan. There was another typhoon in 2017, name of Lan, and there was some late reporting on this event, and that explains the negative prior development on property for once. But overall, as we say, it's positive. So both casualty overall, but also special lines continue to deliver positive prior development. That's the whole picture.
Thanks, Stephen, for your questions. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Thomas Seidel from Bernstein. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon. First on ReAssure again. Christian, you say it's an attractive segment, but you're not the best owner. I mean, what we do know is that it's a low ROE segment, and given management is paid for ROE, I wonder why you think it's so attractive and why you shouldn't sell down closer to zero rather than staying at the 49% mark you're indicating today. That's my first question. What keeps you from selling down really close to zero? Second question, investment income. Stripping out the 265 million from mark-to-market stuff, you have just 40 million realized gains in H1, compares very low to the previous year. So my question is, why is this abrupt change on realized gains, and is sort of the 40 million we see in H1 the new normal run rate?
All right, maybe we'll start with Christian.
Yeah, so yeah, maybe I have to qualify attractive, right? By attractive, I mean there's tons of people knocking on our door who would love to have a piece of that, who find this attractive, right? There's a lot of people, there's PE funds, there's all kinds of people in the market who find that attractive. There's a shareholder who are interested in high dividend yield. They find it very attractive. You can see the other big company who does that in the UK, Phoenix, and their valuation. And so from all of that, it's clear that this type of business is attractive for a whole set of shareholders, and not necessarily for Swiss Re. You're right. So I can definitely see shareholders for whom this would be very attractive business, including the growth prospects and all of that. Swiss Re, once we go down, once we don't own it, deconsolidated and all of that, right, then you have other aspects of the business that are attractive. The cash profile, for example, is attractive. The cash IRR is attractive. The dividend cable is attractive. So at this stage, we certainly would like to stay a shareholder of this, but on a much smaller share, on a share that is not consolidated and doesn't create the SST type issues, right? You also look at it differently from an SST perspective once you have a smaller share. So it really looks different once you're a smaller shareholder. And to stay in and have the people we know, the business we trust, all of that, to me, makes sense.
John, maybe on the realized gains.
On the realized gain, Thomas, you're right that even if you adjust For the change in the U.S. GAAP guidance, you get a return on investment of 3%. That compares to 3.5% a year ago for the first half of 2017. I don't think it's correct to assume that the 40 million or the 10 basis points above the running yield is the new normal for our investment portfolio. I think the asset management team took a look at where markets were, where the portfolio was, and felt that that was an appropriate set of actions in the first half of this year. I will say overall, with rising interest rates on the fixed income portfolio, obviously the unrealized gains are shrinking. But I think it's pretty clear that we would have the opportunity both in some parts of the equity portfolio, the private equity portfolio, the real estate portfolio, as well as fixed income, that if the asset management team felt it was the appropriate time to harvest some of those gains, that they would be doing so. So I would not plug 40 million into your model as the new normal.
Thanks, Thomas, for your questions. Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Frank Kopfinger from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody. I have two questions on ReAssure. My first question is on the site constraints for a potential IPO. Could you comment on firstly, whether MS and AD would be willing to do the IPO if the valuation would be below their level? Then secondly, can you touch also on the reaction from the regulators, which you got so far? And thirdly, whether the IPO itself depends on a deal. And so this would be the side constraints. My second question is, on a standalone basis for ReAssure, can you quantify the cash and debt capacity that ReAssure as a platform has as of now? So to do further deals without IPO, or whether the company is already at the limit?
Let me see, Frank, if I've understood the questions correctly. The first one, the time constraint, if that was your question, we...
No, it's not more on this. Sorry, I called it site constraints.
No, look, we've obviously spoken with MS&AD in advance of this announcement. They are supportive of this action. We'll see as we progress how we move this forward. But I don't think there's either contractually, certainly not, nor operationally a floor that we have to worry about in terms of pricing for the deal. We will not bring this to market if we don't think it's in the interest of all shareholders, including MS&AD. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we've got a hard hurdle that needs to clear. I will say also, since MS&AD made the initial investment, you know, we've announced the Legal & General transaction. We've paid out $1.1 billion dividend to all shareholders, 15% of which went to MS&AD. The business continues to move forward, and while its U.S. GAAP returns on equity look pretty meager under the statutory accounts on IFRS, we see a much more positive result. So I think we don't feel as though we have our hands tied. We also don't feel as though we've got any absolute need to do this. We are not at the limit of transactions. We are open for business, as I said before, and can go ahead and transact should a interesting opportunity arrive in the market. So we've explicitly told the management of ReAssure that they should not reduce their activities vis-a-vis new business.
And John, there was also a question regarding the reaction of regulators.
Regulators, we've informed the UK regulators as well as the regulators here in Switzerland. I'd say their response was neutral with no particular concerns raised to us, but a strong desire for us to keep them informed of progress.
Thank you, Frank, for your questions. Can we take the next question, please?
The next question is from Thomas Fossard from HSBC. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Two questions on my side. The first one for ED, maybe to come back again on the renewals, because looking at slide 21 and looking at the strong increase in casualty, it seems to me that casualty is going up 16% year on year. So can you give us a bit of additional granularity on what is driving that, and especially because I find it a bit difficult to reconcile with the chart you're showing on the corporate solution side, where you're showing that the actually the U.S. General liability at Corso has decreased by 21% in terms of writing over 2 years. So I know that we are comparing Apple to peers, but I mean, it seems to be very, I would say, differentiated underlying trends. So if you can help us to reconcile what's going on. And the second second question would be again on ReAssure. So clearly, this has been over time a very big generator of cash for the group, dividend as well, and you paid 1.1 in Q2, and actually it's been managed for cash more than for earnings over the past year. So, I mean, in terms of cash generation, and obviously this is not the only cash generator engine you've got within the group, but I mean, with this IPO, this will be, I mean, a significant decline in cash generation within the group. So how we should think about it going forward, and how are you going to replace somewhat what is going to be lost with the IPO process? Thank you.
Heidi, on the first one.
Yeah, the first one is regarding, let's say, the portfolio composition, and it's correct. On the P&C reinsurance side, the casualty share has increased. If you look at first half 2018 versus 17, this comes to quite an extent from Asia, and also to some extent from transactions where we had some successes that explains this increased share in casualty. As we explained in previous calls and meetings, we remain quite selective on U.S. liability overall, as this is a segment where we still see need for significant improvement. We could achieve some in 1-1, but clearly that's an area where we stay quite selective. And versus the different picture in corporate solutions, actually, as you have seen, we grew the corporate solution business quite a bit first half year, 18%, and that comes from a number of sources. First, obviously, is the bearing some fruits of the primary lead initiative. And if you look at lines of business, it's quite spread, some in engineering, aviation. The Bradesco joint venture in Brazil is also starting to bring some additional volume. And again, also in corporate solution, as we said now for quite a while, we are very selective on U.S. general liability, where we have pruned the portfolio quite a bit in large corporate risks, taking down capacity and also premium significantly. And this segment continues to be underwritten very selectively. On the other hand, we had some growth also in the U.S. on employer stop-loss business. And another segment where we could grow in corporate solution is around financial and professional lines, particularly with an MGA, which is running very successfully, which explains also some growth that is showing up under U.S. casualty. But clearly, we remain selective. We grow in the pools where we see the profitability meeting our hurdles, and we continue to drive improvements or are willing to take away capacity where we see terms and conditions and price not at the level we like it. Yeah? But a main reason is obviously there's always some transactions that tend to impact this portfolio composition quite a bit from 1 year to the other. So it's not so easy to fully explain.
Thanks, Eddie. John, on the ReAssure cash generation post-IPO.
Look, I think you're right. The Life Capital and specifically ReAssure has been a big provider of cash and dividends. On slide 11 of the deck, you'll see that's been particularly true for the last 2 years, but important in previous years. But in some ways, you know, our view is that were we to sell our share down, obviously that would simultaneously bring cash into the group and at the same time reduce the amount of equity capital that we've got tied up. There are currently $6 billion in live capital. That would be a smaller number absent a vastly expanding pie. What we do with that capital, I think, is something we can discuss in the future when we're closer to an actual IPO. But at the moment, our capital management remains intact, is what we've said in the past. We need the capital to in the first case, run the businesses we have. In the second case, to defend the ordinary dividend. In the third case, to look to expand the existing businesses, and if there are opportunities in the open books of Live Capital or in Corso to you know continue to build scale, we're happy to do that so long as it's value creating for all shareholders. And finally, if we can't do any of those well, then we repatriate capital to shareholders. And I think our track record on this is strong and transparent.
Thank you, Thomas, for your questions. Actually, we have come to the end of our Q&A session, so thank you very much to all of you. Please do not hesitate to contact any member of the Investor Relations team if you have follow-up questions. Thank you again, everybody, for your participation today.